Thanks, Nabil. Well, it's always a pleasure to come back to Santa Barbara, of course, and to talk to you guys. So yeah, right. So my talk's going to be about transport dark fuzzy particles with some holography in it at some point near the end. But for a good half an hour, I just want to tell you about how we should think about the right way of thinking about transport when you don't have fuzzy particles. Okay, so that means that you don't want to think of it as a sort of video ball bouncing around the metal and hitting atoms occasionally. But we are going to head to black holes in a minute, so I should say at the beginning, the main reason that holography, so the most non-trivial thing that black holes and holography do for you in this whole game is it's a fundamentally different way of describing dissipation than happens otherwise, right? So as you may know, classical black holes have some kind of first law whereby the change in the mass of the black hole is equal to the surface gravity times the change in the area plus or minus the potential times the change in the charge of the black hole. Okay, this is a purely classical equation. And then you do this clever thing of putting a H bar here and a H bar there, and calling this the temperature, and this the entropy. Okay. But it's still a purely classical equation. Okay, and this kind of trick, whereby the temperature is very small but the entropy is huge, is really something that the non-trivial thing that black holes do here. Okay. We'll come back to that at the end. And this has been used a lot in the last few years, and I just want to highlight, even though it's mostly orthogonal to what I'm going to talk about, this is a very nice work by Subir. And so one of the problems is, so holography is a large n limit. Okay. But unlike most other, large n limits are very familiar in condensed matter physics, but unlike most of the other large n limits, this equation means that dissipation survives a leading order at large n in holography. Okay. In most other approaches, like the large n vector model, dissipation, what happens is that the n goes to infinity limit and the only goes to zero limits don't commute. Okay, e.g. So these. So this is mostly going to mean something to people who know what I'm talking about already, but I'll start again. So these limits don't commute. For example, the ON model at finite temperature. And this causes real problems, actually. So the ON model arises describing is the Wolfson-Fischer fixed point, right? So you have temperature, you have some fixed point, you have some coupling that dials you from some sort of superfluid phase to a non-symmetry broken phase. And here, if you want to go into this, okay. So you can check that if you use the Boltzmann equation in this ON model, which is what you're supposed to do according to textbooks, the results you'll get at the critical point don't obey certain sum rules that have to be obeyed. Okay? And in fact, holography, and it's related to this order of limits. You know what, I decided I don't want to go into this too much. So there are certain sum rules that are theorems, okay? They have to be true. They involve things like the integral of the conductivity over all frequencies from zero to infinity, equaling something nice, universal. But there's another sum rule that the integral from zero to infinity of one over the conductivity also has to equal something nice, okay? And in a Boltzmann approach, in this weakly coupled approach, you basically have to choose between whether you think your basic quasi-particles are electrons or vortices, okay? And in one case, you satisfy one sum rule, in the other case, you satisfy the other, but you can never satisfy both. You sort of pick the classical description. But holographically, you can satisfy both at once. Okay, so what I'm trying to say is there are pre-existing cases where holography has done some non-trivial thing in transport. But however, I'm going to talk about something different in this talk, and that's about systems of finite density. So finite density means that you have a theory. This theory has a U1 symmetry. Let's think of that as electromagnetism, okay? And then we add to the theory a chemical potential mu for this U1 symmetry, okay? What that will do is induce a charge density, a non-zero charge density under this U1. Okay, so the picture we have in our mind is that we have some number of electrons in the box. Okay, so the charge is the number of electrons. when you have a charge density, that has very important consequences for transports, okay? Which is the most important of which is the following. So transport means that you want to do the following, right? You want to apply an electric field to your system, and you want to measure the current that you get, right? And then Ohm's law relates the current and the electric field, okay? Now, suppose that there's a conserved vector-like quantity in your system. So the momentum being a typical example, but there might be others. Then if you have a net charge, so if you have a net charge density and you apply your electric field, the charges just accelerate, okay? And however often the charges bounce into each other, as long as momentum is conserved, it's always going to drag the current along, and the current can never relax, okay? So you cannot, if you have a conserved momentum that overlaps with the current, meaning that whenever there's current, there's momentum, okay? Then this conductivity is formally infinite, okay? Because the current is dragged along by the momentum is conserved, so you get a current without the electric field, which means the conductivity is infinite. So this condition, that there's a net charge density, is very important. Suppose there was no net charge density, so the charge density was zero. Then that's like saying you have the same number of electrons and positrons, if you like, in the system. So then you can carry currents by having electrons going one way and positrons going the other way. Okay. That carries no net momentum because they're going in opposite directions, so the current is going that way. Okay. They can then collide and stay at rest. And that's relaxed the current whilst conserving momentum. Okay. However, if you have more electrons and positrons or holes, then this doesn't work. Okay. There'll always be some momentum left that'll be carrying the currents. Yeah. So this is a brilliant, we won't get anywhere unless everyone's on board at this point. So, is everyone happy? Good. So where that shows up, so we're going to broaden our perspective a little bit, and we want to think about what's called the optical or the frequency-dependent conductivity. So we can drive the system with a frequency-dependent electric field, we'll get a frequency-dependent current, and we now have a frequency-dependent conductivity.
That's all an optical means? You just put an omega there?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Now, in particular, at this quantity, not all of it's physical, because so this comes from Fourier transforming Ohm's law. So the physical conductivity is of course a real number, okay? But the Fourier transform of the conductivity is a complex number, okay? Fourier transform a real function, you get something complex. And it turns out the real part of the conductivity is the bit you really care about, okay? So if you do this, if you apply your alternating electric field to the system, the amount of heat you will generate is proportional to the real part of this optical conductivity, okay? So it's the density of states, right? It measures how many degrees of freedom there are in the system that overlap with the current at a given energy scale, okay? It's the spectral function. It's related to the imaginary parts of the current two-point function. The imaginary parts of two-point functions are spectral waves. So this is the guide that you really want to calculate. Okay. So if you, in a perfect metal, by which I mean a metal in which momentum is conserved, there's no lattice, no nothing, just a bunch of electrons sitting there, the autoconductivity will look something like this. There'll be some curve that sort of tells you how many charged excitations there are in the system at different energies, and then there'll be a huge delta function sitting at zero frequency, okay? And this delta function is this non-relaxing current that I told you about before. It's this zero frequency limit of this guy. It's infinite. Okay.
But it otherwise goes to zero at zero frequency. Except for the delta.
Just in plot. Sorry, what was
it? Is it important that the curve, except for the delta function, goes to zero?
I think that
zero
the frequency? Real parts of this guy probably has to be odd in omega in general grounds. It definitely doesn't have to go to zero.
That's at zero temperatures.
Right? And this is a zero. It's certainly. Okay, we're going to see all kinds of things happening in a minute at this point. Because I'm going quite slow, I'm going to skip that comment. Well. Okay, so now I just want to take you, I think most people in this room are coming from a high-energy background, on a little tour of what becomes of this plot when you actually look in a real metal. Okay, perfect metals don't exist, so what's out there in the world, okay? And so the conceptual map that you want to have in mind is this one. So what I want to argue is that the way that one should think about this problem is in terms of the fate of the delta function. So option one is that the delta function just gets broadened a little bit. Okay, that's called the Judah peak. That's what's supposed to happen, right? These are conventional methods.
Okay, but still peaking zero.
Still peaking zero. Another thing that's also, you know, reasonably conventional is that the effects of momentum breaking are so strong that the things just can't move at all. Okay, and then it's insulating, and so an insulator looks something like that. It has no low energy spectral weight. You have to excite the system by some finite amount, some gap, some frequency, before you get any charge transport at all. Okay, it's gapped. It's the dimension of this thing, it's a gap. Then in between is where the fun stuff happens, okay? So strange metal is gonna be, okay, so part of the point of this slide is to make a distinction between strange metals and bad metals for people that might have heard both words before. So I'm going to use strange metals to denote something that does have a Judah peak. So the plot still looks like this. However, this Judah peak is going to be unconventional in the sense that it's not what you would find in a textbook. This could mean, for example, that this tail is very broad. Okay. So normally, for instance, right, there's a separation of scales. So the UV scale is out here somewhere. That's one electron volt. Okay, it's a chemical potential scale. And then this Judah peak, the width of the Judah peak denotes a well-separated scale, okay? It's localized. Something that can happen sometimes is this Judah peak sort of seems to go all the way up to the UV, so there isn't a clean separation between UV and IR physics. Another thing that can happen is the DC conductivity, which at this point can scale with temperature in ways that conventional kinetic matter find strange. Okay. That's a strange metal. So it still has a well-defined Judah peak. Can see the remnant of the delta function, but it doesn't behave in the way a textbook written more than 20 years ago would tell you.
It sounds like instead of strange metals, could be further subclassified depending on whether it's this long tail.
So strange, I'm going to mean something with the well-defined Judah peak, but not a conventional Judah peak. So it's somewhat even stranger are bad metals, where the thing stays metallic. So metallic means that the resistivity increases with temperature. Okay, that's the definition of the metal. But there's no Judah peak at all, so it looks something like that. Okay, it's not insulating, it manages to conduct, but there's no what we call coherent transport. Okay, we don't see this delta function has gotten completely destroyed, but it hasn't become insulating. Okay, there's still a conductivity, it still conducts. This is a difficult thing for conventional. So in most conventional theories, for example, if you have disorder, if you have like free fermions with disorder, when the disorder gets too strong for it to be metallic, it suddenly becomes insulating. Okay, so finding something on the brink like this that's still metallic is a strange thing. This is called a bad metal.
It's quite a value adjustment there. Is it bad for
Yes. It doesn't. It's a bad conductor. The resistivity is larger than it would be. The conductivity is smaller, so it conducts less well. It's the bad edition.
So it's bad at being a metal. Okay.
Okay. So now often these two things can come together, but they're conceptually different categories. Okay, so let's start with what a conventional metal would look like. So graphene is certainly not a conventional metal from a material science point of view. But from a theorist point of view, this plot is exactly what one should expect. So graphene is a two-dimensional material. Okay. I'm sorry, I've lost the. This is a frequency. This is a frequency chart. Axis. And so, what's happening on this plot? Okay. So, this is what the dispersion of graphene is. Just a Dirac fermion, as hopefully many of you know. And then what you can tune is what's called the gate voltage, which is basically the chemical potential that you're putting it at. How much of the Fermi C you fill. And these different plots correspond to different filled amounts of the Fermi C. I'm sure many of you, significant fraction of you, heard me talk about this slide before. It's one of my favorite slides. Okay, so then what happens? So if you're at energy scales well above the chemical potential, which is this EF, so if your energy is well above that, then you don't see the chemical potential, okay? So the chemical potential might as well be at zero. You're probably at much higher energy scales. Then it's particle hole symmetric, okay? At large frequencies, you don't see the fact that there's a finite density because you're probably at much, much higher energy scales. And so in 2+1 dimensions, the conductivity is in fact dimensionless, okay? Check that on a napkin or something. And so there's in fact a universal conductivity at large frequencies, so that's this constant. Okay, so this constant, so graphene is in fact a free CFT, okay, it's a free fermion, right? It's a free, and it has a dimension, so it has no intrinsic scales, and so when you probe it at large frequencies, the conductivity just tends to a constant. This is in fact, this dissipation is precisely this process where you've got electrons going one way, positrons going the other way, and they just annihilate. Okay, that process gives you universal conductivity, which is this limit that you see there. Okay. And then at low frequencies, we have a nice Joule peak, which is some impurity or something in the sample that is spread out the delta function. And what's this increase? So this increase is something quite nice. So the low energy excitations of the system are electrons that you just kick out of the Fermi surface here. Okay, those are the low-lying excitations. But when you're pumping enough energy in, right, when your frequency is big enough, you suddenly have enough energy to take an electron from the lower band and also excite that. Okay? Mm-hmm. And so when you're driving it, which is of course 2, so actually this is 2 EF, right, twice this distance. When you pump it in with this much energy, you suddenly have access to a whole bunch of more excitations, and so that's why the curve looks like this. So this is called, in general, sort of the interband scale. Okay? This is when you put in enough energy, you can start pulling out electrons from occupied bands. Very good. So this
is different colors and different temperatures?
No. Well, they're different temperature divided by EF. So at fixed temperature, I think they're probably the same. I'm not sure which one they vary, but it's one of the others. Mm-hmm. So this is exactly what you'd expect when you shift the scale around. Mm-hmm. So this is what this everyone understand this.
I think that's a lot.
Another fun thing that can happen that I'm going to come back to later. Our metal, so this talk is going to be about metal insulated transitions at some point. And so this is what a metal insulated transition looks like. So here what you've done is you've taken lanthanum strontium copper oxide, which is a high temperature superconductor. So the phase diagram, high temperature, and then doping. Okay, which is you're basically changing the charge density. And so what this plot is that you sit at room temperature, okay, and you're moving across the plot like that, okay? And you're measuring this optical conductivity, okay? So what happens? So at underdoping, the superconductivity is sort of here. There's a dome superconductivity. When you're underdoped, that's this zero. It's an insulator, okay? It has a sharp gap. So no conduction at all unless you pump a lot of energy into the system, and it goes up like that. it's insulator. And then what's happening as you move across the phase diagram is the spectral weight, so it's basically the integral of this frequency is sort of conserved. Okay. It's moving down from high energy scales to low energy scales. Okay, as the particles go from being unable to move, jammed, to being able to conduct, okay? So, right, and then by the time you get to overdoping, you have a nice big Joule peak, okay? So over here, it's dimensional metal.
Is the right top? purple is all non-integral.
A little one.
Here, there's a mesh through the peak, here, insulating. And then here in the middle, which is where all the fun stuff is happening, okay, the superconductivity and the thick and things like that. Well, you might think that we're going to get some kind of bad metal, okay, where it's not sure whether it wants to be metallic or insulating. Okay. We'll see that better in the plot in a second. Okay, so this is an illustration of the metal insulating transition. Okay. Now, it's clear that from a quantum particle point of view, these transitions are going to be very hard to describe, because in a metal, your quasi particles are waves, okay, and in the insulator, your quasi particles are excitations sitting at points that occasionally hop, okay. So the fundamental excitations of the system undergo a drastic reorganization across the space diagram. And at this bit in the middle, you might be not sure what you're meant to use. Some more beasts that one finds out there. These are actually metal things that a lot of interest in at the moment. So these are a class of insulators that are, okay, candidates for being quantum spin liquid, which is something that people have been hunting for 20 years. And they've not found them. And the reason I'm showing you this one is that it's insulating, okay? The conductivity is going to zero at zero frequency, right? But it's not gapped, okay? It has a power law. So the insulator I showed you before look like that, right? That means you have to pump in some energy before it conducted. Here, it will conduct. So these are log-log plots. This that one is, yeah, and this one is. So this line at low temperatures, don't worry about there being many. This one is a cleaner case. So it's a power law, right? So the frequency is, the conductivity is vanishing like omega, something like 1.4 in this system. Okay, so it's an insulator, but it's a softly gapped insulator. Yes.
I want to ask you a silly question. Is this 1.4 a rational number, or is it just kind of... No. This has to do with... Well, we can understand this as some anomalous dimension of something that makes sense, or...
This... well, you can see the plot as well as I can.
No, I realize this, but...
So these power laws, it's hard to know exactly. So... So the best... current best theory of this gives it the power of 2. Okay. I mean, it's some strongly interacting, which in experimental papers referred to as a triumph and so, you know. it's probably, if it is a spin liquid, it's some very strongly interacting thing. And yeah. But by all means, okay, this is what it is.
So why do you call it an insulator?
So I think the resistivity will probably decrease with temperature, decrease the resistivity. Yes, right. Which actually we can see in this plot. So yes, exactly.
Yeah, I'm saying
that. Did it go? No, it went the right way. Right, and this means, I mean, the whole point of this, the reason it's interesting is that there have to be some collective massless neutral excitations that these guys are scattering off, that in the best of all possible worlds may be emergent gauge fields, right? So these spin liquids are candidates for emergent U1 gauge fields. Okay, and so finally, here's what a bad metal might look like. So here, we're sitting at this point, at optimal doping, okay, where the TC is highest, and we're moving up in temperature. Okay. So note this is a log axis here. So these Drude peaks are sharper than they look. And so at low temperatures, you have a pretty sharp Drude peak. But then when you get to 400 or 500 Kelvin, okay, it's still metallic, but you've just totally lost the Drude peak. Okay, it's just flat.
So what is TC in the system?
Below 100 Kelvin. Okay, so this is what a bad metal might look like. It's a range, at least over some range of temperatures, it's metallic, okay? The resistivity is increasing when you increase the temperature, but there's no sharp Drude peak. Okay, it's just flat.
I'm sorry, the current
conductivity is increasing.
No, the conductivity is decreasing with temperature, so the resistivity is...
That's sigma.
And is that a linear increase?
Yes. Oh, but yeah, I mean, there are all kinds of fun things. So one of the mysteries of this thing, by the way, is that, right, if you plot the DC resistivity, it just looks like this, okay? And it goes straight through this point without noticing that anything happened, okay, which is a confusing...
So this is a second order phase transition?
No, there's no phase transition.
No phase transition at all. But then you're differencing bad metal and...
Okay, so yeah, there's a little...
It's not a well-defined and very... There's no clear-cut distinction between whether you're one or the other.
So here's... Yeah, okay, so here's a problem. So the point... This is why they were originally called bad metals, actually. So this point, where it's flattening off, happens to be roughly equal to another point. So this resistivity here, this is resistivity against temperature. So on this first slide, I had this thing that I didn't explain, which is called the MIR bound.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which is the Moatz-Joffrey-Riegel bound. Okay, it's going to take a 5 minute argument, so I'm not going to give you. But so suppose you have well-defined quasi-particles, and those quasi-particles have some quantum wavelength, lambda. And then they also have a mean-free path, L, okay? One of the conditions for both the weakly coupled description to apply is that the mean-free path should be bigger than the quantum wavelength. Otherwise, they're just not classical at all. They're scattering. The scattering is wave-like, if you like, kind of the point of charge now, okay? If you take the quantum wavelength to be equal to the mean-free path, that gives you a value for the conductivity. The formula. And some people argue that if you have a resistivity bigger than that, it cannot be described by a weakly interacting description, because if there were a weakly interacting description, the quantum wavelength would be bigger than the mean free path. Okay. That's an argument that has been made. And the point where you cross that is exactly the same point where you lose the durability, okay, within some parabolas. So you could make the argument that the nature of transport should be changing strongly at this point. Okay? It's not a phase transition statement about equilibrium property, but it's a statement about transport. So there's a theoretical argument that nature of transport should be changing. In the optical connectivity, you do see it changing, but the DC connectivity is still in place. Okay? So there's some tension with the set of ideas there.
So that phase transition
around
your purple
405. Well, there's no phase
transition. No, I mean, just
how can you? Yeah, it's somewhere around here. Yes. And actually, there's a the reason these things can't be connected, okay, is that so there's this sum rule, right? The interval, the conductivity has to be the same. So here you have an electron volt, and here you have so normally you have a Drude peak, and suppose the Drude peak starts flattening. The sum wall is saturated when all the weight of the Drude peak is basically a square box here. So when it's as incoherent as possible, it's basically when it's uniform all the way up to the... Suppose it were uniform all the way up to the electron volt scale, then the sum wall actually tells you what this thing has to be. Okay, so there's a whole web of interconnecting concepts here. But indeed, you would expect it, there's a theoretical argument that when it flattens, it should saturate. And that's what happens, yes.
So in a standard Fermi liquid, you know, the resistivity would grow like T squared.
Yes.
But that still means that the conductivity is, DC conductivity is getting very small at high temperature, right? So you would expect the Drude peak to sort of generically go down. This doesn't look so unusual. That's the rate.
You'll see that. What happened, let's say, in the Fermi liquid disorder, is that when you hit this point, it would become insulating. So it would transition from a Fermi liquid, at least in the simplest. Okay. So these points.
So it comes down and then just becomes an insulator.
Let me say your Fermi liquid description is going to break down before you reach this point.
I see.
Because any wrong max, you have to correct me, but I think that's actually
might be interesting. Sean, one question. It looks like it's UV sensitive, the value of the universal conductivity, because it's like a square, it's going all the way up to the EV. Is that
that true?
Yeah, probably, you probably have to put in the value of the electron volts.
Question set.
It's a 2-minute calculation, but I won't be able to do it. I think it's universal, I should do that. Okay, so that's what's out there. So now let's how do we think theoretically about these things? So, I mean, the conventional, right, so the way people most often think about these things is by using a Boltzmann equation, which basically means you have a bunch of excitations that you write down an equation that describes how they bump into each other as they move along. Okay, and that's an intrinsically exact description. So instead, let's try something different. Right, so you could argue that you cannot get people. The argument has been made that these bad metals just cannot be described using a Boltzmann equation. And also, this metal insulator transition in the middle is only expected to be described by a Boltzmann equation, but you don't know which excitations to use in spinning one of the metallic ones. However, so let's think first about the case when there is a sharp Drudery. Okay, so it looks something like this, like the connectivity. Even if the theory is strongly interacting, there is a small number in this game. Okay, so, and the small number is the width. It's true to P. Okay, so remember, when you see bumps on the real axis, that's telling you that if you had plotted it in the complex plane, there would be a pole sitting very close to this axis, right? And the imaginary part of this pole, gamma, is the lifetime, which is right, this width. Okay. So the natural thing to do is to do perturbation theory in this lifetime. Okay, which you can do even if your theory is strongly interacting. This is telling you that the momentum relaxing effects, okay, remember if momentum was conserved, you'd have a double charge, right? So the momentum relaxing effects are small, okay, that at low energies, right? That's what this means. And so we'd like to do perturbation theory in that. So the idea is that, right, exactly. So the sharp Drudery peak means the momentum relaxation rate is small. So then we can treat momentum non-conserving operators. So what approach are we taking? So, you know, we want to do quantum field theory because we're talking about low energy, but energy is well below the lattice scale. Okay, so there's going to be some continuum theory of quantum field theory at low energies. Right. So here's the electron volt scale. So we're at energies well below that scale. So here we have a continuum description. Now in the UV, of course, there's a lattice, right? So this lattice is, of course, has to be present in the IR, right? But if you want translation variance to almost be exact in the IR, that's telling you that the effect of these operators are irrelevant in the IR. So the lattice should be an irrelevant deformation. It gets a bit subtle in some circumstances, but or at worst, it should be marginal with a small coefficient.
Yeah, so if it's actually irrelevant, I mean, it seems like you still have a finite effect at exactly zero frequency, which I would have thought was the absolute end of the IR.
Let's turn on a small temperature. It's a small temperature.
I see.
So that's at a scale.
That's
so there is
a scale. Okay.
It's like proton decay or something, right? The leading effect is given by an irrelevant operator, and here the leading momentum relaxation is an irrelevant operator, which, yeah, you need some temperature.
So if temperature was zero, this Drudery peak would recontract to,
I think that's
the delta function again. Yes.
Yeah.
Perfect lattices have infinite.
You know, that's only true if you have no interactions. I mean, so that's the thing about block waves, which is for free fermions. But when you have interaction, a nonlinear action, I'm not sure that that's a theory. So this won't compare. Yeah. Okay, good. So you might expect that when there's a sharp Drudery peak, you can set up a perturbation theory in these irrelevant operators at least at low energy and low temperatures. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
This is not usually how it's done, but it's obviously how it should be done. All right, so what about a Fermi liquid? So, a Fermi liquid, of course, see, when the whole thing's weakly interacting, you don't have to go through this game because you just calculate everything in the theory. When it's strongly interacting, then before. So Fermi liquid is having Fermi surfaces in momentum space, and the low energy excitations are particle hole pairs, particles popping out of the Fermi surface. And so that has some effective action, which I'm going to be very schematic, which is just a free theory of fermions, okay, that describe the excitations of the Fermi surface. So then we can ask, what we have to do is deform this theory by some operator that depends, that carries the Brake translation variance, okay, some feeds the IKLX, okay, some space-dependent operator. We want this operator to be irrelevant in the Fermi. So it turns out that there's a little story about why you don't have a bilinear term, which I'm going to skip because of time. So it turns out that the leading irrelevant operator is this operator that's quartic. And so this is an operator that's quartic in fermions, okay? And it doesn't conserve momentum because the momentum add up to the lattice momentum. Okay. This is called Umklapp scattering. And it's a process where you grab an electron here, an electron there, and you move them to the other sides of the Fermi surface. Scattering, and it doesn't conserve momentum. Okay. So this is an operator that you can add to your effective theory, and it turns out to be irrelevant. Okay. And actually, from the scaling dimension of this operator, you can derive this well-known fact that the resistivity of a Fermi loop feels like T squared. Okay. We'll do an RG flow version of that. Okay. So this way. So the way you get that the resistivity goes like T squared in a Fermi liquid, okay, a very famous well-known result, the way you get it from the RG point of view is to think of these Umklapp as irrelevant operators that have some scaling dimension that then sets the temperature dependence of the resistivity. Now, I'm not going to go through these formulas, but I want to show you that they exist. So you might imagine that you can systematically set up a perturbation theory in this coupling that's becoming irrelevant. So you can do that. Have a name. It's called the memory matrix formalism. Not to be confused with the memory function formalism that predated it. And this has been used, for example, in 1 plus 1 dimensions to study the resistivity of Luttinger liquids. Okay. So 1 plus 1 dimensions, you see, the reason it's natural is that the Luttinger liquid is sort of an integrable theory. So actually, there are infinitely many conserved charges. And so you really need a lot of scatterings to relax all of them together in activity. And because you need a lot of scatterings, the effect is actually quite small, and so this treatment works. So these guys, Rosh and Andre, did that. And so the idea is the following, that you express this thing M is called the memory matrix. Okay? These are the conductivities that we want to calculate, and we just write it like this. So what we're doing, what we're trying to do, the reason for doing this is that this quantity, if this goes to constant, this omega goes to zero, that'll be the location of the pole. Okay? And we expect that to be small. We're looking for circumstances where that's small. So the right thing to do perturbation theory in is this quantity here. And just to show that that's actually correct, so this is just a definition, okay? You can rewrite it like this. And then you need to have a formula for M, right? So there is a formula for M, which is this, and it's this thing. Given the time, I'm actually not going to talk about. It's a slightly unpleasant formula. Q involves some projections, and L is the loop, some time-evolving operator. But the point that you're meant to look at is that it has an A and a B in it, okay? In the simplest case, these are actually all matrices, okay? And so these are, but in the simplest case where momentum, there's only one conserved quantity, A and B could be, for example, the momentum operator, P. Okay.
So these matrices are, in
So what you have to do is include all the operators that you care about. So what you want to calculate is let's say the electrical conductivity Jx, Jx. Then you have to consider all operators that you think are going to be important. So that would be let's say Jx, T the electric current, the heat current, and then you also need the momentum. So then you consider a matrix of conductivities, sigma AB, which are basically the two-point functions of these three guys. Okay. So this sigma and this chi and this m are a matrix that take values in these three vector operators. And so these A's and B's, basically like this M sub AB. Okay, it's the AB component. And the one that wins is the sort of the smallest eigenvalue of this matrix. We'll set the relaxation rate. By the way, these projectors, it's very, very similar to time and perturbation theory. You have to generate eigenvalues, you have to insert some projectors to make sure that things work. Okay, it's a lot like that. Okay, so these A and B run over these operators, J, T, and P. And suppose that P dot is very small, okay, which is what, so the P dot explicitly enters here. So if you know that P dot is going to be small, then this quantity will be small. So what this shows you, very, you know, fast level, is that this M will be small if there are quantities whose derivatives are small and that overlap with the currents. These chi's are susceptibilities, okay, so. So what happens, right? So let's say the momentum is conserved, but the current is not conserved, okay? Then you start with some state. So the charge is, of course, conserved, okay? So d mu, j mu, or 0, right? But the integral spatial component of the current, ddt of that has no reason to be 0, okay? Ddt of the charge is 0, right? Or the current. The current can relax. So you set up the current. Now that current will have some overlap with the momentum. So when you set up a current, you also set up a momentum. And over time, the current tries to decay because the momentum is constant. And at the end, momentum drags some current along. Okay, that's the picture. And so these chi's are susceptibilities. Okay, they're things like chi jp, which tells you how much momentum you get when you apply a current and how much current you get when you have some momentum. Okay. So roughly the way it works is you apply a current, the susceptibility converts the current to a momentum. You then have a p dot there that's small. So you separate into a fast process and a slow process. Okay, these chi's are sort of the fast process where the current degrades as much as it can while conserving momentum. Mm-hmm. And then the fact that the momentum decay is small is then what gives you this problem. Okay. You can derive this formula. But then, for the case, in general, it's not easy to evaluate this thing. So let's look at the case of scattering by a lattice. So when you scatter by a lattice, momentum is conserved up to the lattice momentum, okay? So you only have k close to k. You can't lose momentum in any other way. You only can lose it by scattering up the lattice momentum. So you can derive the following formula, which says that the rate of decay of momentum due to a lattice when the lattice is irrelevant to the IR, okay? So it's perturbative in some coupling. It's the following. So O is the operator that couples to the lattice, okay? So we're taking our theory, that was translation invariant, and we've added this irrelevant operator that carries the lattice momentum. So this says, take
which
the group.
Is the Ohm-Clark?
In the Fermi liquid, it would be the Ohm-Clark, for example. But it's the leading irrelevant operator in whatever theory you have. Take the two-point function of that operator, okay? This guy. Take the imaginary part, which is the spectral weight. Okay, so then you're measuring how many excitations are there in the system that overlap with this operator. Okay. And then evaluate that at low energies, but at the lattice momentum. Okay. So this is a direct, you could have guessed this formula, okay? It's saying that the rate at which the theory sees the lattice is how many low energy excitations there are at the lattice momentum. Okay. So Diego and I wrote down this formula.
The susceptibility there is PP?
Which? There's a chi of PP. This is a number. It's in a relativistic theory. Yeah, in a relativistic theory, this is E plus P, the energy density plus the pressure. Tangential, but I can't help. It's a very beautiful thing, okay? So this T-squared resistivity, let me just show you how non-trivial it is, okay? So you have your Fermi momentum. You have your Fermi surface that has some Kx. Okay, so let's start with the boson. So low energy boson also has low momentum because momentum costs energy, right? So if you take a low energy boson and you scatter it by some K-lattice, there are no bosons over here anymore. There are no low energy degrees of freedom. There are no low energy bosons at finite k. So this guy has nothing to scatter into. Okay? And if you looked at Fermi's golden rule recently, you remember that there's a density of states of the endpoint that you're scattering into. Okay? And so this thing is exponentially unlikely to happen. So if you heat it up a little bit, there'll be some Boltzmann excitation of states here. But a relativistic boson will just go straight to the lattice without seeing it, okay? Because it has no Lorentz excitations at the lattice momentum. However, Fermi surface does, right? So there's another momentum in the game, which is Pf. So this umplatt, which goes from here to here, from here to here, and this momentum plus that momentum is KL, okay? Stays on the Fermi surface while moving. So everything on the Fermi surface is zero energy, okay? So you can scatter from low energy to low energy while not conserving momentum, okay? Which you can only do because there's another Kf in the game, okay? So to get a big resistivity that's not exponentially small, you need Kf and KL. So it's a non.
Sean, the 1 over omega in that formula seems to suggest that the scattering rate at zero frequency would be enormous.
No, this thing, no. This thing is all.
That I'm
sure about. That this
there's
thing.
Some zero.
These omegas always show up there when they have to.
Yeah, most formulas for dissipation have a 1 over omega, so they can get omega to zero.
Okay, so I'm going to go super quick over this slide. But actually, it's interesting that holography, because it's not the main message of this talk, but you should all know this. Holography gives you another way of getting a power law that's fundamentally different to a Fermi surface, okay? Which is that if you, okay, so I'm going to jump to it, I'm assuming you know what holography is. Right, so when you have a charge density, when you put your system at a finite density, you need to have an electric flux in the bulb, okay? And at zero temperature, the simplest way this can happen is if you have an extremal horizon in IR. This extremal horizon, the near horizon geometry, controls low frequency physics, is ADS2 plus R2. Okay. This has a very, very funny property that it has a scaling symmetry in which time scales but space doesn't. Okay. So if you have an R goes to lambda R, T goes to lambda T, but you don't scale space. Okay. This implies that there exist low energy excitations at all momentum. So if a Fermi surface looks like this, this semi-local quantum critic alpha is hung in the middle, remarkable that it has excitations everywhere in the momentum space. Okay? It's an overachieving Fermi surface. I can give a whole talk about this, but.
Sorry, what kind of scaling does that use for the resistivity?
You get a non-universal power, where the power depends on the dimension. Right. So here, because K is dimensionless, okay, this is where the semi-bit comes in. So you might have thought that if momentum doesn't scale, it would just drop out of everything. Mm-hmm. But precisely because it's dimensionless, the dimensions of operators can depend on the momentum. Mm-hmm. And that's generic, in fact. So in fact, there are theories of local criticality, but I think they're not generic because they don't put in the momentum dependence of the dimension of operators. Okay? So then the least irrelevant operator has a dimension that will depend on the lattice momentum. That's what determines the dimension of the least irrelevant operator at the lattice momentum. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You look at the lattice momentum, you take the least irrelevant operator there and you can do this dimension.
Yes.
Yes. And that determines the
easy.
Yeah.
Sir? What gives that?
Yeah, no, another talk. I don't think there's a totally come on now. I want to get to some also interesting things that are not related to it. Firstly, John, okay, just for people who have thought about these things, let me say, you can get this thing without an entropy density at zero temperature. And I think it's interesting because it comes out quite naturally in holography, and it's a fundamentally different way of scattering efficiently off a lattice, okay, than the Fermi surface. That's interesting. All right. Good. Recalculated this, and actually Gary and George and David Song, you put in the lattice on the computer and numerically calculated the thing. They did other stuff too, but among the things they did, they checked that this formula is correct. Correct. So this sort of effective field theory calculation, yeah, is correct. very good. So I've talked about the case. So what I've given you, very good. So whenever you have a well-defined entropy, whether or not your effective theory is strongly coupled, you at least have a formula that deals with resistivity, which you might or might not be able to calculate, but it's a universal low-energy formula that only depends on the effective theory. Okay, so what happens if this lattice becomes tuned somehow and it becomes relevant in the IR? Okay. So you might expect that that's going to drive you perhaps to an insulating phase, okay? Because the effects of the scattering off the lattice are going to be very, very strong, and the degrees of freedom just won't be able to move. So, right, so the claim is that this probably doesn't describe full metal insulator transitions, because actually this is an interesting thing that I only appreciated recently after we wrote this paper. So the Drude peak was something like this in chi over omega plus gamma, right? So if you want the DC conductivity to go to zero, you have two options. You can do what I'm telling you, which is that gamma goes to infinity, but another option is that chi goes to zero. Okay. So this means that, right, okay, they're two logically different things. Okay. So one is that you keep the weight in the Drude peak, but it gets spread out, and the other one is you just lose the weight. Okay. And actually, I think that many, the more conventional one is that this thing goes to zero. The one I'll tell you about is that you can also send this gamma to infinity. Very good. So what happens, right? So my claim is that you will get a metal insulator transition if momentum non-conserving operators become relevant in the low energy field. This can happen. So what Aristos Donos and I have found is a holographic realization of this, which I'll spend the last 10 minutes, I hope, telling you about. Okay. So the idea now is we want to set up. Okay, so maybe I should say.
So in all of these cases, it's not I don't see any sharp transition.
Let's get there. We'll get to that. We'll get to that. But indeed, so these metal insulator transitions do not have to be symmetry breaking transitions. In fact, there's sort of two classes. Often it happens that the insulator is accompanied with some magnetic order or something. Yeah. But it logically doesn't have to. In fact, in the spin liquid case, that's precisely what doesn't happen. Right? That's the whole point. Yeah. It doesn't have to be a symmetry breaking phase transition. I'll get to that. Oh, so I should say, good, in 1 plus 1, there is a previous existing example of this. Yeah, sorry. So you have a Lovinger liquid in 1 plus 1 dimensions, and you have a lattice. And actually, the Umklapp coupling in the Lovinger liquid is actually a marginal coupling, and you can tune its strength. And as a function of that, the momentum's conserving. Anyway, there's a free crap. There's a line of Lovinger liquids. Okay. As a function of that line, the Umklapp operator changes dimension and, in fact, can become relevant. And so you will get, and in that case, it gaps the theory. So you get a BKT-like transition in a Lovinger liquid, which is exactly what I'm saying. So I'm talking about a higher dimensional version of something that there's a proof of principle of that it does exist. Good. And so I should have said this example that the Gary and Georgian friends looked at, but agrees that gives you this metallic case. So if you just take Einstein and Maxwell in the ball, and it's plus a cc, of course, then it turns out that, and you add a lattice here, this lattice is in fact irrelevant in the IR, which is the regime of parameter space that people have looked at. Okay. So that's why this calculation we did agree with what the numerics. So now I want to find a theory, a bulk theory, where this lattice will become relevant to the IR. We're going to see what happens. So this is probably not the simplest way to do it, but it's just the way that we did it. Okay. So we're going to have, this is going to be the Einstein-Maxwell sector, okay, that carries a charge. And then we're going to add another vector field that could be massive in principle. It's not too important. And we're going to make the lattice out of this extra vector field. Okay, I'll show you how it's set. And it turned out that for technical reasons, it was quite useful to have this Chern-Simons term, although I believe it's not fundamental for what we're going to do.
So what's B?
DB is W.
Well, B is the same, right?
It's a
proper.
Yes.
Well, just quickly come back to
the
chi and gamma. I mean, effectively, in an insulator, still the Drude weight will be zero, right?
Well, this is what I'm saying. So, for example, in these models of the central ones you talk about, for instance, I think it's a well-defined. So you could ask, take the Drude peak and go across the insulating transition. It's a question of whether you see the weight go to zero as you go across the transition or not.
Okay, but let me just look at zero temperature.
Yes, zero temperature, yes. No, so I think it's a difference. So in one...
I think in an insulator at zero temperature, we threw it away. I mean, there's no...
No, in the... Yes, clearly the DC connectivity is zero, right, once you're in the insulating phase. But the question is sort of how you approach it. There's sort of physics of it.
Maybe it's a nice physical picture, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, so it might be difficult to disentangle them mathematically. But the reason, so for example, if you have some emergent, so in, for example, Sentel's models of metallization, what he gets at the critical point is some emergent particle hole symmetry that sets this pi to zero. Whilst the insulators I'm going to discuss do not have an emergent particle hole symmetry at the critical point, and it's really more like this gamma potential infinity. Let's talk about it later. It's an interesting. I would like to understand it better. Okay, so this is going to be the theory. Okay, so we're going to take. So if you take this theory, just write it like that. And so the first thing you want to do before setting up any numerics or anything is to try to find what are the possible places you're going to land. Okay, so you look for the IR geometries. Okay, so you find that this theory has an ADS2 plus R2 IR. Okay, solution. But it also has another solution that I'll show you in a minute that lets, preempting ourselves a little bit, let's call it the insulated solution. Okay, there's another IR geometry where the lattice doesn't drop off in the IR. I'll show you in a minute. And so, logically speaking, there are two ways of making a phase transition. One is that you imagine varying something like the amplitude of the lattice, and that when the amplitude is small, the RG flow flows you to the metallic fixed point, but when the amplitude is big, it flows you to the insulating fixed point. That's one thing that can happen. So there you'll never see an instability of the metallic phase, because whenever you float, once you're there, you're there. Right? Another thing is that you could float to this metallic fixed point, and there's a function of dialing something else, a relevant operator could develop within this metallic fixed point, and then flows you down to somewhere else. Okay. So I think that both of these happen in this theory, but the one that we looked at in this theory. Okay, so we're going to find the metallic point and see an operator become relevant within that fixed place. Okay, so here's the clever technical thing that we did, I think. So unlike George, we didn't feel like solving PDEs. Right, so why do you need PDEs? Because you have a lattice here. Mm-hmm. So you certainly have x dependence in that direction. And they also have the r dependence in that direction. So your Einstein equations are going to become a PDE. Okay, but it turns out that, and this is based on work of several previous people, although we did something really different. If you have a helical lattice, which means your lattice is a vector, okay, it's not a scalar, the operator, and that as you move forwards, it rotates in space. Okay, that's what this is describing, right? That this has some pitch, so helical. That configuration is actually homogeneous. Okay, it's not isotropic, but it has a symmetry group that acts on it, which is called the Bianchi 7-0 algebra, which is as big as the it's big enough. It's homogeneous.
At least as big as the translation parts.
Yes. Right. So it has a kind of non abelian translation symmetry. And so if you use this, it means that we can integrate in this lattice only solving ODEs. Okay. Because mm-hmm. we have one more symmetry. But what this will mean, figured. So it's going to be a three dimensional boundary. You need three dimensions to have this mm-hmm. symmetric lattice. So it's going to be this x1 and then it's x2 and x3. So the lattice is in the x1 direction, so it's insulating if you shoot along the lattice. But if you were to shoot parallel to the lattice, it would still be a delta function. Okay. And actually, this is called a symmetric metal, and apparently, it's some exotic, exciting thing. It's very. Just not that time.
The metals like that exist?
Well, okay, so the reason there was a lot of interest in this is that so high TC superconductors are very, very bad, effectively insulating in this direction, but very good in that direction. And at some point, I guess in the late 90s, Anderson had a theory that this anisotropy was the key effect of high TC superconductivity. This book that maybe people have seen that says the theory of high TC superconductivity, what was this theory, which was then disproven experimentally. But so, and it turned out it's hard to make these things. So they are probably interesting, but from our point of view, it's just a technical simplification. Anyone else? Something? Well, the cookies are. Oh. It's good to know the terrain. All right, so good. So we're going to put in this lattice, and then we're going to solve the equations, integrate in, that we have to do numerically, but it's ODEs, the mortals can do them. And then it's a question of what we get in the IR. Okay. So here are the geometries that I told you about but didn't show you before. So this is ADS2 plus R3 with the lattice turned off, okay? But the charge is still there. Then the other one is this thing, okay? Where, let's say, firstly, where the lattice does not get turned off in the IR. Okay? So there's all the one vector field we're taking around all the way in the IR. Okay, so that's good. The electric flux actually got pushed out of the black hole by this Chern-Simons term, and that's what actually helped us find the solution. I don't think it's essential, but it certainly helped a lot to put us to zero. And this transition actually is a lot like the people who might know about it. So Doker and Kraus had a transition in ADS5 between a magnetically and electrically charged. You have a dionic black hole, and as a function of the ratio of the charges, the IR basically jumps from ADS2 to ADS3 or something like that. And so the IR has gone from being electric to magnetic, if you like, except now we have two gauge fields, okay. Two vector fields. Now, this metric is, I just want to, there are some interesting things in this metric. Okay, so there's this part, so R and T are scaling in a kind of, C is just a number, scaling in a kind of normal way. And then, so this is like the DX2, DX3 direction, they're all scaling differently, which is showing you that the sort of lattice effects are certainly big. And this one is actually blowing up as you go towards the IR, which has made some people nervous, but this really is the IR. You can heat it up a little bit. Okay, I'll start to show you. This geometry is what you get in a totally well-defined theory in the IR. But it's interesting that it almost looks like the RG flow is getting inverted from one of the directions. Okay, which is not quite right because X1 is not a symmetry. Okay, there's no momentum in the X1 direction, so you should not be too naive. But there may be some interesting physics in this geometry. People that care about these things. It's not an exact solution, it's the leading term in an asymptotic solution.
Sorry, it's not an exact solution.
It has some leading, so this is the R goes to infinity limit of a solution. The leading, these are the leading powers as R goes to infinity.
I see. Mm-hmm. And just to understand, the statement is that doesn't satisfy the equations, or that it satisfies the equation, not the boundary condition, if you want to imagine.
No. This, so you solve the equations exactly. You imagine there's some function like h of r, dt squared, g of r, and then you expand those as r goes to infinity, and these are the leading terms.
Okay.
It's not a decoupled IR geometry. But
yeah.
On the other hand, it's sort of. So for example, all the finite, how everything, if you heat it up a little bit, you'll see that the entropy and the connectivities will have some temperature dependence, there's some powers. And all of those powers you can get analytically from this geometry. So it's sort of it's controlling the low temperature physics, at least effectively. So now this relates to David's question. So we want to show that there's a phase transition between these two. And what we're actually, so there, what are the parameters in the system? There's the strength of the lattice, lambda on the boundary, there's KL, and there's the chemical potential mu. So at zero temperature, taking dimensionless ratios, you have a two-dimensional parameter space. Okay. Just due to lack of patience, we just looked at one slice in the space, okay, which is we fix lambda and we change this ratio. Okay. It's KL is P. So what here? So the solid line, okay, very good. This is the free energy. So what you do is you start in the IR. At zero temperature, you use these two solutions and you integrate out and you see what you get. And you see there's one free parameter, you move it around, and you move around the UV, and you can get the free energies. So this solid line, this dashed line, is a zero-temperature solution using, I forget which, one of these. This dashed line is zero-temperature mitigating out from the other one. In the middle, the zero-temperature numerics became a little unstable, so we heated it up just a tiny amount. That's this dashed line, but you can see. Okay, so this is the first evidence that there's a phase transition between the two IR geometries, which is a function of the size of the lattice and fixed chemical potential. Better evidence for this is we can plot the entropy at a finite but small temperature as a function of this guy. And although it's not a nice quantity, it's not a nice fact that AdS2 equals R3 has a zero temperature ground state entropy, but in this case, we can use it to tell which phase we're in. Okay. So indeed, we see on one side, so we zoomed into this box, here there's an entropy at zero temperature, these are different temperatures. At the lowest temperature, the entropy is going to zero about here. So this is the insulating phase, that's the metallic phase. I think it's an infinite order phase transition. Not being KT. Last slide or two. All right, so now we have the backgrounds, okay? So we have the full background where you start with this insulating IR and you integrate out, and now we can calculate the conductivity, which holographically you do by sending some finite frequency waves through the geometry.
And I'm sorry, what parameter were you changing, did you say?
Yes, fix the size of the lattice. Sorry, the height of the lattice.
The height of the
lattice. I changed the PL, the pitch at fixed chemical potential. So by the way, this is actually, it's realizing this picture. So what you find is that you have the metallic solution all the way down, and then an operator turns on, that becomes relevant. And that's why it's infinite order, because just when it first turns on, the dimension is arbitrarily marginal. So,
do you know what operator it is?
We have this. Yes. Okay, so this is the picture that I was most happy about. So now let's plot. Let's go back to the rest of the talk and let's plot the optimal conductivity. Okay. So in the metallic, so note that I've truncated this. This is just here, right? Because in the metallic phase, the interesting stuff is just the Drude peak. Okay. So when on the metallic phase, these are different temperatures. So the highest temperatures, you get this beautiful conventional Drude peak, and you can calculate this temperature dependence, everything's fine. And as you move across the phase diagram, the spectral weight shifts, and in the insulating phase, it looks like this, okay? So all the spectral weight that was in the Drude peak has gotten pushed out into higher scales, okay? And now when you lower the temperature, the velocity goes down instead of going up, okay? So indeed, when this operator became relevant, you get an insulator. Right? So this is meant to. That's why I showed you this plot. Okay, it's a spectral wave transfer from the Drude peak out to the interband scales. It's kind of some interesting things to talk about, like this bump and so on, but I will not now.
What is bump?
it's just there in the numerics. So there's a whole story about mid-infrared peaks in the cuprates, and so there may be such intermediate bumps. So, for example, we actually, from lack of time, don't have data all the way across the transition, but you might expect that this bump, there's some energy scale associated with this bump, right? Actually, something that someone suggested to me that may well be true is that it's a oscillating sliding mode. So normally, how does this work? Right, so suppose you have a spontaneously broken translation variant state. That's not insulating, because the whole thing can just translate. Mm-hmm. So it wants to wobble, but it's being tied down by the lattice UV. I suspect that it's some mode that wants to do that, mm-hmm. but we haven't looked at the system. So you could check that so the claim would be that if you tune up the amplitude of the lattice, this frequency should get bigger or something like that, right?
Is that a quasi-normal mode of your black
hole? It must be. Yes, but it may have a physical interpretation of this wannabe sliding mode.
Maybe more than one. You have to look at it in the full complex plane. This is just a real part.
Yes. It wouldn't suffice. It's a pretty okay. So anyway, and finally, so from knowing this geometry, we could actually calculate analytically the frequency, and it goes like omega to the fourth lattice, which is not a million miles away from the 1.4. But I'm not as brave as Gary and friends. It's probably not related, but anyway, you can calculate. So actually, it's an insulator. It's an interesting insulator. Okay? It's one of these power law gaps, which is not surprising because there's still a horizon. There's still masses. It's still deconfined, if you like. It's just insulated. Okay. So now I really am nearly done. So just to check. So we calculate the conductivity in the metallic phase using this memory matrix formalism. In the insulator, we got it from knowing the zero temperature geometry. there are in fact bad metals in between these two. Okay, which we haven't. So we originally, the idea of this project, we originally wanted to look at bad metals, but then got distracted by the metal insulator transition, but they are there. There's this interesting peak. Time for that comment. Right, so let me just summarize. So the objective, right? So unfortunately, it might not help that many people might not be aware of the usual quasi-particle description of transport is, but that's not what I'm doing. So the idea is to set up a non-quasi-particle language for a way of speaking about transport that doesn't depend on some billion balls bouncing around. Okay. And so the idea is that a good metal is when you have an effective low energy theory in which translation invariance holds up to perturbative effects in momentum non-conserving operators, or developmental or marginal but small operators. And when these effects become relevant, you get a metal insulator transition. And holographically, we realize this scenario. And we found a simple model that has some nice features that are difficult to describe in general, including this huge spectral wave transfer, bad metals in the middles, and then insulators with all low gaps. Okay, so I think that's enough there. Okay, thank you.
So I can see that there can be an instability to the spectric phase, or what, some operator, this helical structure that becomes.
So it's not a dynamical instability, right? It's an RG instability.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. See, it's not a dynamical instability.
So those things also exist, and you know, Hiroshi Ohuri and Jerome Goldman and Donaldson. There's been a whole study about strike instability, which is also interesting, and actually this theory can have those, but we put ourselves in some region of parameter space where it's stable.
I see.
So we put in the lattice by hand,
okay.
And it's an RG question about whether it's relevant or not.
Okay, fair enough. I still want to ask the question. Yeah. I take it that in this case there is not, for some reason, a similar instability to just a superconducting phase that would be translation invariant.
Well, we haven't put it in. I mean, so Gary and friends have looked at competing effects of lattice, well, combined effects of lattices and superconductivity.
Right. But I mean, in this model, as you've written down,
there's no charge field, so there's no
can't
way.
Be okay. This is sort of the only thing you can do.
It's the only thing.
I mean, if I just started and I said, suppose I had a vector field that was unstable, is it sort of clear that it should do this or something similar?
So unstable again, now we mean in the RG sense.
Let's say in the RG sense, yeah.
Yeah, no, so exactly. So I think it's doing.
Is there such a thing as I'm not seeing why I couldn't have a homogeneous vector field turned off. Why does it have to have
it? It is homogeneous. We did this clever isotropic.
Why does it have to have this particular symmetry group? Why couldn't it?
Oh, that's just a little bit calculation. Right. So if you don't have the symmetry group, then you have to solve PDEs to find to integrate into the geometry to find to integrate in.
But could there also be a configuration where the vector field just sort of points straight down? The
yeah. So that's what. Gary and George and David looked at. But that's not homogeneous, it's fewer
symmetries. No, I think Don's asking, if you have no lattice at all, nothing which acts like
No, good, yeah. I understand. So if you don't have a lattice, and there's instability, then of course it's a non-trivial question what configuration the lattice takes, right? And in fact, this might be under study at the moment.
But I'm putting in
the lattice, so it's really this slipping mode. There's something that's holding it down. I don't think that this theory has instabilities towards the lattice changing shape as you go in, but in principle it could exist.
That's sort of the flavor of my question, but I'm just wondering if there was an instability in the RG sense to having a homogeneous configuration which was not isotropic, but where the vector field all pointed this way.
Was there a translation?
No. Sorry, I want to make translation invariance, of course.
This is my question. You want the breaking of translation invariance to be from this RG instability?
No. The breaking of translation invariance is put in by hands in the UV, as it would be in a physical system. Okay. And then the question is whether that UV effect has strong or weak effects at low energy.
Right. But you're talking about the dimension of this operator or its instability relative to this ADS2 cross R2 phase. If that was already unstable to going to some other homogeneous phase.
No. But right. Good. But so relevance kicks in before instability. So relevance kicks in when it becomes marginal, and the instabilities kick in when you go below the BF balance, which happens later. So
relevance means
RGB elements. So it turns on.
Right.
Before it becomes unstable.
And by unstable, you mean dynamically unstable. But again, if there was some other RG relevant operator that was translationally invariant, I'm trying to understand whether there could be some other competing RG relevant operator.
I think I finally see it.
Which is translation.
So that would spontaneously break some, right? So I've assumed it's good.
I'm basically trying to ask, is it clear that breaking the.
I see. No, I think no, it's not being sourced, right? So we have some symmetry in the UV.
Yeah.
And unless there's an right, that's. So the operator with different symmetries is just not being sourced in the UV. So I think they cannot.
Kind of a spontaneous.
Right, so I think that doesn't happen in the.
You want to break rotational.
Yeah,
spontaneous.
But it's breaking rotational variance.
Right, that requires instability, which we're not in a regime of parameter space if that happens. You're right. So I think what you.
That requires a dynamical instability, you say.
Yes, that's right. And if you were there, then what could happen is you start with some lattice in the UV, and indeed, maybe the IR lattice would rotate with respect to it or something. That's logically possible, but not in the.
What's the parameter that tells you that?
It's the BF. You need models below the BF bound, the IR.
Okay. I see. So you say, you know, for some reason, this only happens when there's a dynamical instability.
And I think that's true. It's like, you know, if your theory has some Z2 symmetry, you don't generate operators of latency. I mean, there's a symmetry in the UV that will not allow these things to be generated.
I see. Okay.
Let's thank Sean again. And